playback on RT Radio 1. Sponsored by the all-new Irish Times Weekend. With new writers like Marion Keyes and Sean Moncrief, your weekend's in good hands.
Good morning. Yet again this week we've had the Tory Brexit Punch and Judy show, and then the headmelt that is Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin, a face for every season. On Monday, standing alongside the Russian president in Helsinki, President Trump was asked about foreign interference in America's 2016 election, and he appeared to side with the ex-KGB officer Putin over his own director of national intelligence, Dan Coats.
People came to me, Dan Coats came to me and some others. They said they think it's Russia. President Putin. He just said it's not Russia. I will say this. I don't see any reason why it would be.
On Tuesday, following intense criticism from his own party, Trump offered this clarification.
In a key sentence in my remarks, I said the word would instead of wouldn't. The sentence should have been, I don't see any reason why I wouldn't. Or why it wouldn't be Russia. Sort of a double negative. So you can put that in, and I think that probably clarifies things pretty good by itself.
In the same statement, Mr. Trump accepted that America's intelligence agencies were right. Russia did meddle in the 2016 election. But in his very next breath, Trump suggested that maybe it wasn't the Russians after all.
I accept our intelligence community's conclusion that Russia's meddling in the 2016 election took place. Could be other people also. There's a lot of people out there.
A.B. Philbin Bowman reporting for Drive Time on Thursday. Well, now it appears Vladimir Putin is coming to town.
The announcement of Mr. Putin's invitation to the White House appeared to take the US Director of National Intelligence, Dan Coats, by surprise when told about it at a security forum.
Vladimir Putin is coming to the White House in the fall.
Say that again.
Vladimir Putin coming.
Did I hear
to the,
you? Did I hear you?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's going to be special.
Meanwhile, back in the real world, Ruth Fitzmaurice and her friends were Ray Darcy's guests. Ruth, you may remember, lost her husband Simon to motor neuron disease last October, and her book, I Found My Tribe, tells of dawn swims in Greystones and how the freedom she found diving into the water calmed her down while caring for Simon. Ruth's tribe are her swimming pals, African Michelle, whose husband Galen was paralysed after an accident. The women share a WhatsApp group called Mermaids of Awesomeness, and as you'll hear, they really are awesome.
And this is going to be black humour, but your husband is, he's completely fine.
No tragedy. No,
no tragedy. Because the reason I feel I can say that is because there's a chapter in your book called Tragic Wives.
Yeah.
Yes.
She's what we aspire to. She's sort of our, she's sort of the, you know, the balancing effect on the group. So it makes her feel good to hang out with people who have really shit stuff. So obviously.
Well, that's awesome.
Yeah, because humour is hugely important. It's quite dark,
it's
isn't
massive.
It?
Yeah, it's really important.
I'm intrigued to know, because I often have this conversation about people who die and the long goodbye and the sudden death and, you know, the pros and cons of each way. Like, Simon was diagnosed when he was 34 and he lived till 43, but it was always terminal, wasn't it?
It was. He didn't really look at it that way. He was, you know, obviously he was very much, I concentrate on living, but, you know, he was given a prognosis of 3 or 4 years to live. So,
And then Galen, then it just happened.
Yeah. Galen was
blink of an
36.
Eye.
Yeah. 36. And
so that changed your life beyond recognition.
Yeah, absolutely.
What's the chats that you've had about that, the differences there?
Yeah, well, like, it's funny because, you know, I mean, obviously the common thread is, hey, we had wheelchair guy husbands, but and they're very different circumstances and yet they're very much the same. And we would have chats about that after swimming and stuff and just say, you know, which is more difficult, the gradual decline of somebody or that sharp cut and dealing with the aftershock. We haven't really figured it out yet, you know. I mean, I think it's just being...
Both are shit.
Both are really shit, exactly. Both are utterly shit. And, and there's a real, it's a real blessing to obviously to have a friend who understands in any small way what the circumstances at home are like, because most people want to just make it the brave story, the great story. And just to have that comfort of knowing that someone will look you in the eyes and you don't even have to speak, and they get it. Yeah, I mean, yeah. I wouldn't be coping as well as I am only for this lady here, you know. And plus, she's a psychologist. Everybody should have a psychologist. It's really, totally. Really useful.
From the Ray Darcy Show on Thursday, another powerhouse, Tressa Reeves, rang Joe on the live line. It was Tressa's first radio interview since settling her historic High Court case against the state and St Patrick's Guild over her son's illegal adoption. Tressa was 20 when she got pregnant, and because of the stigma and shame, nuns who lived near her parents in England arranged for her to come to Dublin for 6 months until her baby was born.
So Andre was born?
Yes, he was.
And how long did you get with him, Tressa?
I had one night.
Wow.
I had one night. He was allowed to come into my room and he slept in a little cot at the foot of my bed, and I was told not to touch him. I wasn't to bond with him. That was for his other mother. And I sat on my hands and looked at him, and then eventually I picked him out of the cot and cuddled him.
Of course, of course.
And I baptised him Andre, because I thought it was an unusual name, and when I came back when he was grown up, I'd find him because there wouldn't be another Andre around. And then in the morning, I stayed awake holding him, put him back quickly before the nurse came in. And then she took him away and I didn't see him again for 52 years.
Tressa gave up baby Andre in 1961. She returned to England, married there, and went on to have four more children. She only found Andre again in 2012 after an exhaustive search. He'd had a difficult upbringing with his adoptive parents, and his birth cert was changed to make it look like his adoptive parents were his birth parents. Andre only found out he was adopted when he was contacted by the Adoption Society.
And effectively, you were forced to hand over your child.
I was, yes. I was. I did it. I signed those pieces of paper and everything because I just knew I would get him. I knew I'd come back. I knew I would, and I did. And I couldn't do it for a long time, but my husband, Dennis, was very supportive of me. In fact, what was so stupid about the whole thing is, and we talked about it years later, is that if I had kept that little boy, he could have come into our family. Yeah. Dennis would have been delighted, but he never said at the time, and I never asked, I never thought to ask, and so that was an opportunity missed, but anyway, that's too sad to think of. Really.
And when did you tell Dennis that Andre...
Oh, he knew when I was pregnant. I'd known him a long time. He was my best friend's brother.
Okay.
In fact, what I didn't realise at the time was that my best friend, his sister, was pregnant at the same time as I was. And he told me years later, he took us to the cinema, the pair of us, and he said he was sitting in between his sister and his going-to-be girlfriend, who were both pregnant at the same time, and neither of them knew about the other.
Wow.
Because her mother told her not to tell anybody. My mother told me not to tell anybody.
I know you're in the cinema, but he was definitely in the dark, wasn't he? He was definitely in the dark.
Well, he was a good man. He was a great man. He supported me.
And is he still alive? Is Dennis still alive?
No, bless him. No.
Okay. And you had four children with Dennis. You had five children, but you had four with Dennis.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And when did they discover that they had it?
I think they'd always known, really. Yeah. I mean, my eldest daughter was great because she was very keen on me finding him. She got cancer and was very ill, and she eventually died. But she was very keen on me finding him.
Yeah.
And she said to me, he's going to be a redhead, Mum. He's going to be a redhead and he's going to be awkward and fall over everything. And I used to laugh about it. And she was so keen on me finding him. And I even told the authorities at the time that I had a very sick daughter.
Mm.
And could they please hurry up and give me my files, because she really, really wanted to see him. And she didn't make it.
And did they take heed of what you said?
No, not at all. Nope, they didn't.
And the story gets even sadder than that, and you can listen back to that full interview with Tressa on the RTE player. There are at least 126 other cases where adoptive parents were wrongly and illegally registered on birth certs. Bernard McGrath rang Joe. He now lives in England and only found out that he was adopted when he was 40. It took him a couple of years to trace his birth mother, who'd married in America, all on the QT because her husband didn't know. She told him that she never got to hold him. He was taken from her immediately. And 2 days after he was born, Bernard was illegally adopted out of Temple Hill in Blackrock.
What happened was, my birth mother gave birth to me in Tipperary.
Right.
And when I was born, I was taken away straight away. 2 days later, I was in Black Rock.
In Dublin, yeah.
In Dublin. Yeah. But my birth mother was told, oh, he's not well, he's not well. You can see him tomorrow, you can see him tomorrow. And this went on for 3 weeks. And then she was told, oh, he's gone, you'll never see him again. My mother, who had a relation, who was a mother superior with the Sisters of Charity, mm-hmm. they couldn't have children, so she was told to go over to Black Rock. She went over to Black Rock and was brought into a room with three cots, and she was told, which one would you like? Mm. So she just picked one out, and she was told to go down and register the birth, and that's what happened.
And the name you were registered in was totally different to your mother's name.
Oh, yeah.
Your birth mother, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I was registered as Bernard McGrath, but my birth mother named me Martin. Her name was Scully.
So your real name is Martin Scully?
Well, do you see that?
From Liveline with Joe Duffy on Tuesday. Family was also at the heart of Paula Meehan's conversation with Keelan Shanley last Sunday morning. Paula, who's one of our most distinguished poets, was mostly raised by her grandparents in Dublin's north inner city, while her parents were making a living in England.
I was back and forth with my grandparents all through my childhood, and they were just so nourishing. They were amazing. It was a great blessing to spend so much time with them, and especially with my grandmother, Hannah, who was a child of Monto, as was my grandfather. They were both born in Monto, which was at the turn of the century when they were born, the biggest red light district in Europe.
In Europe, really?
Yeah. Well, it really, the decline there started with the pullout, and the pun is intended, of the troops after the
revolution.
They
would have been the big customers.
Yeah, and the docks. It was near the docks, so you had that. And it was a no-go area. I mean, it was the gentry were in there, so the police weren't likely to go in and raid it.
With both of them born in Monto, were they involved in the sex industry, do you know? Or
well,
what?
My grandfather's mother, Anna Meehan, was one of the big madams of Monto. She would have been the next generation after Joyce's madams. In fact, she had one of the houses.
Mentioned
features,
in Ulysses.
Oh, yeah, that features in Ulysses. But it was really Monto in decline, you know, after independence, really that industry, because of the rise of a Catholic state, the triumphalism of Catholicism, and of course Frank Duff's marches on the end of the old brothels put an end to it. And the most traumatic, because I don't glorify the idea of having ancestors who ran brothels, but the most traumatic of our history tends to go underground.
So you didn't find out about this through your family?
No, I mean, there were hints and, you know, there were some references and I was picking up stuff, but I just thought it was just poverty and the tenements and, you know, the odd skeleton in the cupboard. I didn't realise there'd be a whole feckin', you know, tenement full of skeletons.
Seven brothels.
Yeah. No, it was Terry Fagan, that extraordinary keeper of the memory of Monto. He came up to me on the street one day in the 80s, early 80s. I'd just come back from studying in America. And he said, I have great material on your great-grandmother, Anna Meehan. I said, oh, the dealer. And he kind of laughed and he said, you know what she was dealing in? And I said, yeah, old furniture. And he said, oh, yeah, right. And so he started me on the folklore as he'd collected it, because he's our great oral historian of the North Inner City.
As one of a generation of women in poetry who fought gender battles, Paula Meehan says she's always going to write about the problematic, the unresolved, be it personal or cultural. Well, no doubt her closeness to her grandmother Hannah fueled that passion.
And Hannah was that, a very common mix in the inner city of, she was very, very pious. She had great total devotion to Our Lady, but she was completely anti-clerical. Yeah. And it was a common mix. Remember that the priests had excommunicated the Labour leaders of the inner city during the strike, the general strike. That was a very strong memory for people. So Hannah, grandmother. Coldest day yet of November, her voice close in my ear. Tell them priests nothing. Was I 12, 13? Filthy minded. Keep your sins to yourself. Don't be giving them a thrill, dirty old feckers. as close as she came to the birds and the bees, on her knees in front of the Madonna, Our Lady of the Facts of Life, beside the confessional, oak door closing like a coffin lid, neatly carpentered, waxed and buffed. In the well-made box of this poem, her voice dies. She closes her eyes and lowers her brow to her joined hands, prays hard, woman to woman.
Paula Meehan reading her poem Hannah, Grandmother, heard on Sunday with Keelan. It's obvious that there's a lot of creative energy in Dublin's north inner city, and the Annam concert showcasing that talent in poetry, film and music was broadcast live from All Hallows on the DCU campus on the South Wind Blows last Saturday night. Among Philip King's guests, the heart of the Raoul himself, Damien Dempsey.
I always just remember the sing-song in my aunties and my grannies and my own house and neighbours' houses of pubs and when I was a kid. In the sing-song, you'd always have a terrible singer, you know, Woges. And there was terrible singers as well, but they were sometimes as good as the great singers, you know, because they'd be a great laugh, you know. And then I remember one of my uncles saying to me, I always try and sing after Mick Finglas because he's brutal. And I'm great to
Right. This is a university and we're learning all the time. What are you going to start with?
I'll sing this old song, a real old Dublin song, and it's just the language in it. It's amazing. It's like they made up their own English in the tenements, and lots of writers back then, they always commented on the language of the people in the tenements, but you can hear the stream of rural poor people that came into the tenements, all the generations, their languages in it as well, you know.
Fire away. Damien Dempsey, everybody.
Tim Finnegan lived in Watling Street, a gentleman, Irish man, mighty odd. He had a brogue, both rich and sweet, and the rise in the world he carried the hod. But Tim had a bit of the tippler's way, with the love of the liquor he was born, and to send him on his way each day, the drop of the crate or every morn. Back for the door to the dance, your partner round the floor, you throw the shake. Isn't it the truth? I tell you, lots of fun at Finnegan's wake. One morning Tim was rather full, his head felt heavy, which made him shake. He fell off the ladder and he broke his skull, and he carried him home, his corpse to wake. They wrapped him up in a nice clean sheet, and he laid him out upon the bed, with a bottle of whiskey at his feet, and a bottle of porter at his head. Back for the door, the dance with your partner, round the floor, you throw the shake. Isn't it the truth? They tell you lots of fun at the Finnegan's wake.
Damien Dempsey with Philip King, heard on The South Wind Blows last Saturday night. Ray Darcy was on his holidays recently in Dunmore East in County Waterford, and on Tuesday he spoke with two 11-year-olds, Ned Hawkins and Usheen Langford, who lived there. The lads emailed Ray after they spotted him buying their home-produced comic in the local shop. They've been selling the comics in Centra for 3 months now, and they told Ray more about their business empire, which they call Stellar.
Usheen, so you're what, head of marketing?
Yep.
What else do you do in the company?
I'm also head colourist.
What does that mean?
I'm the one who colours the comics.
Aha.
And I also develop the secret board game as well.
Ned, you're the CEO.
Yeah, I am.
So what does that entail? What sort of things do you have to do?
Well, I have to manage the finances and try to keep everyone happy about it.
Yeah, so I suppose motivation is a big thing, is it?
Yeah, yes, we had a meeting on that.
Yes. So back to you, Usheen. So what's the plan? What's the plan for the future?
Well, we plan to get... Well, we are renting Ned's mum's second bedroom as an office at the moment. But we're planning to first get a second printer, and then we're hoping to get an office as well.
Okay, who prints them for you at the moment?
We print them locally.
Okay, right. And of course that's a cost, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, so if you had your own printer then that would cut down on that cost.
Yeah, by 75%.
Right.
Ned and Oisín, great business heads, heard on The Ray D'Arcy Show on Tuesday. Dave Fanning's guest on Monday was the legendary producer Steve Lillywhite, one of the big beasts of the music industry, lionised for sculpting the sound of superstars like the Rolling Stones, Talking Heads, Kirsty MacColl, Joan Armatrading, and of course, U2. And if you've ever wondered how the collaboration works, have a listen to this.
2004, 14 years ago,
that's right.
How to Dismantle an Atomic Bomb. U2 were always taking very long to do certain albums, and that they didn't have you there doing it, and they went, oh my God, we need to do something. Get Lillywhite. They got Lillywhite. When you come in, what are you trying to do here with U2 with an album?
Well,
like?
First off, we're trying to get a hit single. Second off, we're trying to finish the album. So my first thought was, they played me all the songs, and the song that I listened to, and we all agreed actually, was this song called Native Son, which was a great song. Song about gun control that eventually got released on the U2 iPod, actually, very, very deep after 12 mixes of discotheque. And this song was okay, but I didn't like the production. A U2 production has to sound, you have to love it, but never know quite why you love it. It has this thing about it. So I said to the band, look, can we re-record Native Son? And I want to set the band up with more of a sound from their early days, because I thought this could benefit from much more of a rocky sound. So I set the band up completely differently, and I said to Bono, look, here we have a finished song, go and sing it. Because up until that point, Bono had always written the lyric after the event.
Right.
So he went in and started singing Native Son. Halfway through, he put the mic down, came back and said, I can't sing that. I said, what do you mean? He says, I've got to go around the world for 2 years. I'm not going to be able to sing that song for 2 years. So I said, okay, well, what do you got? I said, I don't know. What are you going to write? So we cut the track. The track sounded great. We then spent the next 2 weeks, every day, him trying to come up with a chorus. You know, one of the choruses I remember was, I know these fast cars will do me no good. Mm. Was a chorus for Vertigo at one point. And eventually, of course, he came up with Hello, Hello. And we went, nah, that's all right. You know, we went home to bed, came back the next morning, listened to it. We still didn't think this was it.
Yeah.
But then, you know, the cleaning lady was going, oh, that sounds nice, you know, and all this sort of thing. And
that's the old grey whistle test.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then eventually we just sort of, is it all right? So there was never a sort of eureka moment that we got it. You know, there have been plenty of eureka moments that have proved to be false dawns
right.
with U2. But normally the ones that stick are just like, oh, we can't think of anything better.
OK, so then Native Son became this.
So that's how it's done. Steve Lillywhite in conversation with Dave Fanning on The Tubridy Show. The world of football was devastated when Manchester United midfielder Liam Miller died of cancer earlier this year. He was only 36, leaving behind his wife Claire and 3 young children. On Wednesday, it was announced that a testimonial game in his honour will be played at Turner's Cross in September. Roy Keane will field a team of Manchester United legends against a Celtic Ireland side managed by Martin O'Neill, with greats like Robbie Keane and Damien Duff, Ryan Giggs and Dennis Irwin lining out. But there was huge disappointment that the game couldn't be played at Parky Queeve, which has a capacity of 45,000, instead of at Turner's Cross, which can only hold about 8. Over on Liveline, a row broke out when Tadhg rang Joe, insisting that Parky Queeve shouldn't be opened up for the Liam Miller testimonial. Another listener, Maureen, a staunch GAA supporter, was having none of it.
No, it shouldn't be available.
Why not?
Because it's a GAA stadium. And soccer people, when Croke Park was made available during the renovation of the Aviva, the soccer people considered the pitches very ropey. And Delaney, the chief executive of the FAI, when it was all over, said it was okay as a stopgap. So,
and you're still holding that against them?
He said it.
So
they were his own words.
Yeah, so
it was
like,
okay. He said it on radio and TV.
And
it
that's,
was okay as a stopgap.
And that's your reason. I don't care if he sang it. It has no meaning for me.
Yeah.
But that's the reason why you think.
Well, the reason is because the rugby people were highly appreciative of the facility of being able to use Croke Park.
Yeah. And the soccer people, as you call them, weren't?
They weren't.
So let them get lost?
Whatever.
Even if it is for a charity event for one of your own?
If they want to run charity events, they should have to provide their own venues.
Did you hear that, fella?
What are you saying, Maureen?
He's such a dinosaur, that man. For God's sake, forget about all things that were said. It's a charity event for a poor woman that lost her husband to cancer.
Come in towards the phone, Maureen, will you? Please, sorry.
I'm nearly sitting on it, yeah.
Okay. Tadhg said the soccer people didn't appreciate Croke Park when they got it. And John Delaney said something. I don't know what John Delaney said.
He's just in the past, that man.
From Liveline with Joe Duffy on Thursday. Meanwhile, the controversy continues following Channel 4's investigation into the goings-on at Facebook, in which an undercover reporter exposed lax regulations and policies when it came to moderating abusive video content posted on its platform. On the News at 1, Claire Byrne spoke with Facebook's content manager, Siobhan Comiskey.
Can we talk about some of the specific examples? Because people who saw that programme will have seen a video where a man was shown punching and stamping on a screaming toddler. Now, moderators were asked to look at that by users of Facebook. And a moderator said, if you start censoring too much, then people will stop using the platform. It's all about money at the end of the day. And it was decided that that video could stay online.
Yeah, I'd like to address that because the issue of child abuse is extremely serious, and we take that matter extremely seriously at Facebook. What I can tell you is that in the vast majority of circumstances, that content will be removed. And in the vast majority of circumstances, we don't just delete those videos. We also take steps to use image matching technology to make sure they are never uploaded on Facebook again. What I can also tell you is that there is a very narrow exception where we will allow that content, and that is where that child is at risk. Where that child is at risk and people are sharing the content to raise awareness of that and to try to bring that child to safety. And not only will we allow that in that very limited circumstance, we will also pass that information to law enforcement so that they can also take the step to bring that child to safety.
But you're then setting yourself up as judge and jury here. You're deciding, well, this child is at risk. Let's leave this up online to allow people to share it, to raise awareness. I mean, who gave Facebook that right to make that decision about that child?
I think that's a very valid question. And I think when Facebook set up a platform, we took on a responsibility. And that responsibility is to keep the people on that platform safe. And what I can tell you is that in that particular example, we saw reports in Malaysian media saying that that child was brought to safety as a result of the neighbour of that person recognising him on the video that she saw on Facebook and calling her local law enforcement and the local police. So in those circumstances, that's the rationale why we have this policy. That's why what we want to do. Our primary purpose is to keep people safe.
Facebook, Siobhan Comiskey with Claire Byrne on the News at 1. Meanwhile, cyber psychologist Professor Mary Aiken was unequivocal when she spoke with Philip Boucher-Hayes.
I think the bigger question is, when is enough enough? At what point are we, as a country, as a people, and those who represent us, going to stand up and say, this is not acceptable? You know, for the action plan to be announced and for companies like Facebook to be invited to sit on a regulatory body in that way to self-regulate, there's an obvious conflict of interest in terms of the profit they make from ads and from content. It's like asking people to self-regulate drink driving, you know, award yourself some penalty points or deprive yourself of your license for 6 months. So I think Facebook's activities in Irish soil, they don't just disgrace Facebook, they risk disgracing us too. And Zuckerberg, you know, he professes contrition like a petulant 8-year-old boy every time he's found out, saying, I promise not to do it again, but it's not acceptable. So I would urgently call on the government to set up a commission to investigate the Channel 4 revelations. And if Facebook will not cooperate, or if they hide behind jurisdictional loopholes, then this government should consider asking them to leave Ireland.
Professor Mary Aiken heard on today with Philip Boucher-Hayes. Well, Tim Desmond's documentary on One told the story of Johnny Cash's first tour of Ireland. It started out in a garden shed in Dublin, where Enda Shortall kept a very special tape.
It's a recording made over 55 years ago.
We kind of gave in.
It's in an old biscuit tin for safekeeping. There was a time everything that needed safekeeping found its way into an old biscuit tin.
USA assorted, what? This is the tape recorder down here, Philip's 4-track.
The recording is a bit like a time machine.
Are we switched though?
Right, we have to wait for the little light to come on here. We might miss something now, you know.
It brings us back to October and, 1963.
Valve lighting up and off we go.
Ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado...
This is it.
We take great pleasure, along with Mr. Bill Fuller, to present the number one country and western singer in the United States, Mr. Johnny Cash.
Thank you very much.
Johnny Cash.
I hear the train a-coming, it's rolling around the bend, and I ain't seen the sunshine since I don't know when. I'm stuck in Folsom Prison, and time keeps dragging.
Narrated by Jim Lockhart, the documentary brings us up close with Johnny Cash's first live encounter with Ireland, a country and people he came to love. He toured with June Carter, who would go on to have a very big role in Johnny Cash's life, but this was the early clandestine days of their affair.
After playing her set, June Carter stayed on stage with Johnny. Listening back, 55 years later, the chemistry between them seems obvious from the recording.
June?
I thought maybe that you and I might sing one together.
All at the same time?
At once.
Both of us?
Yeah, let's try
me
that.
Me and you?
Let's okay. Do that, okay?
All right. You sure look pretty tonight.
Yeah, I know it.
He was in good form that night. Did a great show. And he was Johnny Cash, he was the man in black, that's what we went to see.
Well, I played around and I played around this old town too long. Summer's almost gone, yes, winter's coming on. I played around and I played around this old town too long, and I feel like I've got to travel on.
Johnny Cash and June Carter, and the voice of Billy Lee, who saw them live in 1963. From Johnny Cash's Lost Tour of Ireland, produced by Tim Desmond. Well, I've only played a few teasers, but it's brilliant, and you can podcast the entire programme from the documentary on One Store in iTunes, or from the documentary on One mobile app. In Thailand on Wednesday, there were joyous scenes as the 12 players and the coach of the Wild Boar football team were finally released from hospital, looking happy and healthy after spending a fortnight trapped in a dank underground cave. Well, one of the divers involved in the rescue is Belgian Jim Warney, who's lived in County Clare for the past 15 years. He explained the intricacies of the miracle rescue to Philip Boucher-Hayes and how the boys had to be sedated before the mission could even begin.
And how sedated were they? Because obviously they still had to be in control of all of their motor functions in order to help and assist you. Or were they just given enough to calm them down?
No, they were basically asleep, fully sedated. It wouldn't have worked any other way.
Okay, so then it became essentially like moving another piece of kit behind you or in front of you, yes?
Pretty much, of course. It was a very delicate piece of kit, and if anything would have gone wrong, it would have jeopardized the survival of the boy we were carrying at the time. So it was a precious cargo as such.
Of course. And was it a one-on-one experience, or were you doing this for those 350-metre sections that you describe with a number of colleagues, or was it just you and the boy?
Initially, I was part of the support team on the first day. So I would be in one of the sections where there was surface swimming. So I would meet the diver, take over for a while the other diver has a bit of a breather, and he swaps another cylinder and then swims behind me and dives again further on. And then I would go back for another boy. So I did that the first day. The second day, one of the divers in the team developed a cold and a chest infection. So I was moved forward. So the second day I assisted in a similar fashion. Towards the end, one of the lead divers asked me to assist him. So I got exposed to a bit more one-on-one time with one of the boys. And then the third day, we needed an extra person because there would be four boys coming out and the coach. So I was put forward to bring out one boy from nearly at the end of the cave.
In addition to all of the pressure of, as you say, transporting this precious cargo. Because you saw the level of media coverage before going out to Thailand, you were aware that the eyes of the world were literally on this cave. Were you conscious of that as you were doing your job?
Not so much cave diving, because it's so highly stressful and so goal-orientated. You try to make a mental picture of what you're going to expect, and you nearly rehearse the dive in your head. But when you get all this conflicting information from the media and stuff, it's very easy to make a very bleak picture in your mind and a very bleak scenario, which is very easy, could have been. But once I landed there, we literally arrived at the compound where the cave was, and within 2 hours we were underground. But I was way more comfortable with what I was doing once I was there.
From Today with Philip Boucher-Hayes on Tuesday. Brian O'Connell was in the County Clare this week, checking out who exactly is benefiting from our rising visitor numbers and how fairly the tourist spend is spread.
I was at Moher 4 years ago with the kids, and I remember being struck at that time that the queues to get a photograph with an uninterrupted vista, nobody in the background, were as long, if not longer, than the queues that I remember seeing at the Taj Mahal in India to take pictures in that chair where Diana, you know, everybody wants do that posed photograph. They were 50, 60 metres long, you know, 200-300 people sometimes.
Yeah, and that's the danger with the cliffs. I mean, the great thing about the cliffs more, you stand there, you feel it's an isolated spot in some ways. It's the calmness, it's the quietness of it. And if you're there with 100 people queuing up to get a selfie or a picture, it sort of takes from the experience, doesn't it? And recently enough, when I was in Ballyvaughan in the heart of the burn, not everyone happy there with this increase in tourist numbers, and particularly focus here on the rise in coach tours. Now, I began by walking the village with Karen MacDonald, and then I met local George Quinn inside the community hall.
We do feel the traffic is probably one of the main problems at the moment. The Geopark had commissioned a survey last year, and on one day, 118 buses had come through the village. For example, if I decide I want to go into Galway, I will allow at least an extra 35 minutes onto my journey in case I get stuck behind a bus. Some buses have absolutely no compunction at all about parking footpaths. And they were over by the garage parked in the footpath. Nobody could get by with a buggy. There are families here who live here. They're trying to get around with buggies and they're going out onto the road. I've seen it myself. A bit more etiquette on the roads would help. I mean, there have been times I've been nearly forced into ditches by buses. But they don't slow down. They don't pull in. There is no sort of quarter given sometimes. And that can engender a certain resentment.
My name is George Quinn. I'm a native of Ballyvaughan.
You're a big fan of the buses?
Not at all, indeed. For my premise, if I had my dream, I would ban the buses from coming to the burn. And I would ask the situation where they disembark from the big buses into smaller buses.
Why? What impact do the buses have on your day-to-day life?
They're congesting our roads. Now, they're of no benefit whatsoever. Or if they do stop, their primary need is to use the bathroom. Or if you're lucky, they would have a takeaway coffee. You know, I'm a shopkeeper. I've witnessed the bus coming off the buses. They don't even look at my shop window. You see, there's a big conflict between the two extremes: the mass tourism of the Cliffs of Moher and the sensitivity and the uniqueness of the burn.
Brian O'Connell reporting for the Today Show yesterday. Lauren Weisberger is famous for her best-selling debut novel, The Devil Wears Prada, which was made into a film starring Meryl Streep. Her latest work, The Wives, is supposed to be screamingly funny and is a follow-on based on Emily Blunt's character from the film. Lauren was Dave Fanning's guest on Tuesday.
There are three people involved here in some ways. One of the people is somebody who used to be the face of L'Oreal, who is a supermodel now married to a senator. And is it that the three of them all come together to solve a crime, or is it the three of them come together to undo a wrong?
It's to clear Carolina's name. Like you said, she was the former face of L'Oreal. She's a world famous supermodel in her own right. And she is married to a senator with presidential ambitions. And he sort of sets her up and accuses her. And she, along with her two best friends, Emily, who we've mentioned, and her friend Miriam, work together to clear her name and get her son back.
Okay, but Emily is a kind of a go-to image consultant for celebrities. But one of the problems is just how fast things go in this age that we live in now, because she's not necessarily 100% au fait with social media and just how quickly it all goes. And she gets dumped in New York by a client for somebody a lot younger, Olivia Bell. And is that something you have seen yourself even since, like, anything Devil Wears Prada or anything in the last 6 or 7 years?
Oh, for sure. I think that's something that my friends and I are all talking about now. Like, these millennials are coming in and they're Snapchatting away and we have no idea what they're doing. We can't understand it to save our lives. And it creates just a really interesting situation. I just liked the idea of Emily being threatened by one of these young upstarts who is incredibly savvy with social media.
And you said earlier on, in terms of The Devil Wears Prada, that you honestly don't think that anybody could be prepared for the level of attention that you would have got, the phenomenal success of the debut novel. Were you able to handle that attention?
It was definitely overwhelming. I mean, both in a positive way, which was incredibly exciting and continues to be even all these years later. But there was definitely some backlash and the level of attention, like you said, that I hadn't been at all prepared for. I'm not sure anyone could have. I had no idea. I thought that it was just going to be very exciting that my parents could walk into a bookstore anywhere in the US and buy a book that I had written. I didn't know it was going to go sort of beyond that.
Lauren Weisberger with Dave Fanning. But I leave you now with a song from Tom Dunn and his band Something Happens. They played live on The Ray D'Arcy Show on Wednesday. Gurum haga vasur golúder, gidean tachtan chahugin, gidea shib slán.
Shoot and jump. You can't stay here forever when everyone else is gone. Been all alone, once ain't that clever. Take a parachute and go. There's gonna have to be some danger. Take a parachute.